I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992 here from our perch in 2024. I am one of your hosts, Phyllis Goh.
I'm your special guest host, Emily St. James, sitting in for your normal host, Steven Spielberg, the two-time Academy Award-winning director who emailed us to say, I can't talk about Leprechaun. It's too important to me. So Phil
wow.
called
I was
me.
Like,
and
where is this going?
Yeah. Well, listen, I did an easy Irish joke on the Patriot Games episode, and I was like, no, I'm going to challenge myself. So instead, I did
yourself.
A really long and winding joke that kind of.
You think Spielberg's
like,
seen Leprechaun?
Spielberg feels like he's, you know how Steven Soderbergh releases those things at the end of every year? He's like, this is everything I watch. Mm-hmm. I hope one year it's just like he watched all eight Leprechaun.
All eight Leprechauns.
Like right in a row.
With us today is Jude Ellison Doyle, journalist and author, most recently of the comic series The Neighbors, which is available at Boom Studios. Boom Studios.
I think the studios have only made The Empty Man, but.
Really? That's interesting.
That's a great movie, The Empty Man.
I hear it's a great movie. Too scary for me.
No, never.
Jude, thank you so much for joining us on our Irish episode. Podcast like it's 1992.
Thank you. I think that a lot of things have happened to the Irish over the years, and this movie is probably high on the list.
This is our St. Patrick's Day episode. It feels like, does this encapsulate all Irish, you know, heritage, culture?
I think that it's got a lot of pride in it. It's definitely like it goes as hard at establishing that it's Irish as it can. Like within the first 10 minutes, we've seen like a man stumble up his steps drinking. Like, and you know.
Jude is one of my favorite writers about horror, and his newsletter is a must subscribe for everyone. But before we get into Leprechaun, though, I need to know if you've seen The Empty Man, Jude. I think you would dig it.
I did. I saw it. I thought that was great.
Yeah. The Empty Man.
I'm going to relate it to Leprechaun. We're like, the first 10 minutes of it are essentially a different movie than the rest of it. You know?
Yes, exactly. Like,
interesting.
It's
got that plot.
Yeah.
There, you know?
Leprechaun opens. I would argue that Leprechaun might give you exactly what you want in the first 5 minutes of this movie and then just kind of beat you to death with it for the remaining 80 minutes or so. Like, you get a Leprechaun at the end of a rainbow with a pot of gold. Like, I don't, what
fucking
else
rips.
Do you need?
Yeah. Listen, Phil, we texted me while you were watching this. You were like, this movie's like incomprehensible. It's one of the worst movies I've ever seen. So I went in expecting like just a total shit bomb, and I like had a fun time. I thought this movie was kind of a blast.
I don't mean to suggest, I mean, okay, let me rephrase. It's a movie can be unwatchable and also entertaining, if that makes sense.
Sure.
Like, I'm watching this thing. First of all, I mean, I had some idea as to what I was signing up for. I mean, it is a movie about a, let's just call him a mutant leprechaun, because like this leprechaun is, you know, more of a monster than a leprechaun.
Well, listen, I mean, I don't mean
to judge, but this guy's got claws. I don't know that leprechauns had claws.
So adamant about being a leprechaun, though. Like, throughout he keeps insisting that that's what he is.
Absolutely.
Everyone in the movie is really incredulous when he says it. They're like, "You a leprechaun?" And it's like, "Yes, he's wearing the full leprechaun outfit."
You know what? It's
cared for. Like, he has the little hat and he has this.
He does have the little shoes.
Yeah. Listen,
it's a metaphor for trans identities, and that's that's my argument for the rest of this episode.
My whole thing with this movie. I have a lot of things. I don't know why it takes Jen Aniston so long to finally come around to the fact that he's a leprechaun. She fights it until like the last 10 minutes.
She's an analog for Pamela Paul or a New York Times opinion columnist who's just like, I don't believe any of this.
And then, she denies it really ferociously. I mean, the reality is that I didn't know and continue, quite frankly, to not know much about leprechauns. I don't know that this film teaches me much about leprechauns. Do you feel like, outside of the fact that he wants his gold, he's determined to get his gold.
He yells at some point.
He wears green. He wears a little green outfit. He wears a little green hat and little green shoes. The four-leaf clover being his kryptonite is a little bit of a twist from what I read. That doesn't seem to be part of leprechaun lore. I also don't believe that leprechauns are bloodthirsty in the way that this leprechaun is.
I mean, like, I think that there's a lot of leprechaun lore that's introduced in a really condensed way. Like, it's clear that this is, like, not your mother's leprechaun. Like, there's even a scene where he, like, looks at a box of Lucky Charms and is like, bah.
Lucky Clovers. Yeah. Lucky Clovers, let's be real. It's not Lucky Charms because they don't want to be sued.
It's a Lucky Charms-like cereal, and he 100% rejects it as the truth of his culture. Yeah. But it... like, there's a lot of powers that the leprechaun has that are not really spelled out. Like, very early on, there's an instance of leprechaun telekinesis where he can close doors and it doesn't fully work because you can still open the door. And he's like, ah, my powers are weak. And throughout the movie, he just like sort of has powers. He welds at one
he can teleport. He can control lightning, it seems.
Yes. Really good, like he could get on SNL with how good he is at impressions. Like, that is a thing that he should do.
It is interesting, you know, Emily, I read your Letterboxd review of Leprechaun, and I do think you make a valid point that this movie's attempting to thread a needle of comedy and horror, and I would argue a little bit retroactively. If you read about the production, this movie was supposed to be far more horror. And then Warwick Davis, who plays the leprechaun, the titular leprechaun, sort of enters the project and sees more humor to be derived from it. And that it'd be a little closer to sort of the Freddy world in terms of being kind of winky. So the movie kind of is a little bit vacillating between two pretty significant different tones.
I think like you read a lot about actors who are little people and they are constantly plagued by, I have to play like fucking fairies and elves and whatever and whatever. And like Peter Dinklage just talked about this a lot. And Warwick Davis talked about it before, where he was like, I just keep getting shunted into these roles. And like Willow was like the one, and it kind of flopped. So it didn't like become the thing he wanted it to be. So then he gets offered this. He hasn't had a lot of work. And I totally get why he's like, I want to make this funny. You know, if I'm going to play this role, I want to show off my comedic chops. And I think he, my understanding of why people do love this franchise is because of him. And I do think he's a lot of fun in this movie.
Yes, I agree. The Leprechaun's a stinker. That's for sure.
A little stinker.
He's a little stinker. And I appreciate that about him. Mm-hmm. It's not a scary movie though. Like even when it gets a little gory at times, there's so much that takes place in daylight, which as we've discussed, Emily, I think on previous episodes, like whenever we're in the daylight, like we talked about Pinhead showing up mm-hmm. in the daylight in Hellraiser 3. And you're like, yeah, he's not scary in the daylight.
Sure. Leprechauns so like, are. Leprechauns are terrifying.
Are they?
No. No,
leprechauns on a tricycle in the daylight scare you?
So I am like working on a theory that I just came up with, and Jude can correct me if I'm wrong because he's also a scholar of horror. I think that all horror movie monsters are either men or toddlers. Like they're metaphors for either. And the leprechaun is a metaphor for a toddler. And I was telling my wife this last night, my kid like has a crib and can look into the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And like last night I was doing some stuff very late at night and the kid was sleeping, you know, across the way. And at one point they like, you know, just made a little sound. And like, I was like, oh no, they're awake. And it was like, I was like afraid of a demon. Because if they woke up, I was going to have to get them back to sleep. And I didn't want to do that. So I do feel like toddlers are scary in the daytime and the leprechaun is a toddler.
Okay. I mean, your fears of your toddler aside, which is reasonable.
They're irrational fears.
Well, because I think on some level we're scared of littler things, right? Like I think that, you know, bugs and vermin and like, you know what I mean? Like, I think there is something sort of inherently, and I don't know what it is that's scary about, because we're so much bigger than these things. Like, we shouldn't be afraid of them. And yet, like, last night, my roommate saw a silverfish. And, like, you would think that this thing was, like, a fucking lion or something. Like, you would think that it was just this giant thing to be scared of. So I understand something sort of like the little grandparents at the end of Mulholland Drive. Mm-hmm. Like, there's something scary about that. I don't know what it is. But, like, the leprechaun, I gotta say, there's just... he's shining shoes, guys. I don't know how else to say this. Like, I don't know what's scary about that.
he's ominously shining shoes. And I tend to agree with you that like whenever there are shoe-based death threats where he's like, I'm gonna cut your ear off and turn it into a boot. Like he does try to follow through with the shoe theme, but like everything else in this movie, he just keeps throwing shit at the wall.
Yeah. He's a man on a mission.
I mean, how can you not respect someone who's like that dedicated to like, you know what? If the leprechaun is some unrelated demon who just like really loves leprechaun culture and just like wanted to appropriate it, like the whole time I was thinking, and in my letterbox review, I said this is like, it walks a thin line between goofy slasher and anti-Irish political cartoon from 1855. And like, I was thinking this whole movie about how kind of the normal like arc of what happens in America, or essentially immigrants who sort of get incorporated into whiteness, is they're like hugely despised. And then there's like another generation and like they're not as despised. And basically like, you know, then there's like stereotypes and all these things about them that are considered normal and acceptable. And then gradually the stereotypes become unacceptable. And like then they are just sort of in like, this is a thing that happened to German people. And you never see like German shit. For some reason, Irish people and Italians and arguably Polish people skipped over the step where we're like, this stereotype is wrong. And we're still like, it's okay to say that an Irish person is a murderous leprechaun. We're all fine with that.
It's true that there are certain, yeah, there are certain sort of cultures, I guess, or yeah, I don't know what it is. It's like Italians feel, and Irish definitely feel like it's still free game. Now, I think that might change. I don't know.
I honestly don't think so, because like Irish and Italian people wield enough political power in the United States that it is like, true, it does remain kind of like punching up, unless it's a fucking British person. And then we need them to get the fuck out of here.
We still make fun of the Brits.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jude.
No, I mean, I'm saying that, first of all, it's not, I don't think the stereotype is that Irish people are murderous leprechauns. It's that we are all entangled with murderous leprechauns.
Right.
Over like real estate and property disputes. And it's like, they're like our mom.
And gold.
Like there's always something somebody did to a leprechaun, and we're bringing that, you know, to the United States. It's drunkenness.
I want to put that on record. We're always doing something to the leprechauns.
Yes. There's like, you know, there's Yeats stories about this, about how like they're like bringing murderous elves and she across the wow, ocean by immigrating. It's a real problem.
It's incredible.
There's so much. There are so many like stories about like folkloric creatures coming to America with like the immigrants. And it is just like such an interesting, I think, you know, there is an inherent, it's built, I don't want to say it's racist, but it's built atop this racist foundation of like, there were people who lived here who had their own folkloric culture who largely were exterminated because genocide, which is what you want to talk about in the leprechaun episode, clearly. But like, but also it is like this compelling thing of like, the United States and Canada are nations of immigrants. And therefore, like all these traditions have sort of gotten melted into the soup of what it is to be us. And so like everyone in the U.S., I'm of German descent. I know what a leprechaun is. I know everything. I mean, I don't know everything about leprechauns, but I know that, you know, they want their lucky charms. Like, it's just like, it is this thing of like living in a country that is a melting pot. You get all these weird things just sort of get into the melting pot. And you're like, well, of course, leprechauns. That's a thing we all care about.
Yeah. But I also think that just like Irish people, like now that we have like our second Irish American president and he's also really annoying, like Irish people are just terrible white people. And I think we should be fair game. I think we're like a safe place for the nation to vent its weird, broad ethnic humor.
Do you think Joe Biden was tangling with a leprechaun and like was like, like talked about that on live television? It would probably make his whole thing where people are like, he's an old man, worse. But I also think like people would like him more, you know.
I think that if he went on like a leprechaun rant, it might make him look bad right now.
Well, listen, but you remember when in the 2020 election he kept talking about corn pop and people were like, who the fuck is this? And then people found out corn pop was real. If Joe Biden does a like 20 minutes on how a leprechaun is chasing him around, then
you're
think
find
the press,
out there's a real leprechaun.
So Jude, have you seen any of the other leprechaun films?
I have not. I've seen the posters for many of them. Is there
are many
Leprechaun in the Hood one later.
There's two where the leprechaun
goes to the
Hood.
Leprechaun 2, Leprechaun 3, Leprechaun 4 in space, Leprechaun in the Hood, Leprechaun 2 back in the Hood. Then in 2014, they did a reboot, Leprechaun Origins. And then Origins, which was released theatrically, which is kind of shocking. And then Leprechaun Returns, which is a sequel to Origins, was released on DVD in 2018, which actually serves as a direct sequel to the original film. It's like the Halloween series. They went back.
They skipped all the other ones.
I do think
like one of the interesting things about that 2014 movie is that was when WWE was getting into producing films, and they had a little person wrestler named Hornswoggle, and Hornswoggle is the star of Leprechaun Origins. They were like, we got this guy, he's got a lot of charisma, what can we do with him? Leprechaun. It is a little dispiriting.
Offensive? I mean, I want to read just the synopses of a couple of these just because they're pretty amazing. Leprechaun 2 is about him surfacing in LA to claim a bride. As his previous object of affection was denied to him 1,000 years before in Ireland. He kidnaps a teenager, grotesquely murdering anyone who gets in his way. That's right. So that's two. The third one, he goes to Vegas and a pawn shop owner purchases a statue of a leprechaun from a mysterious stranger, ignores the stranger's warning to never remove the golden statue's medallion. It's gremlins, except it's a leprechaun in Vegas.
You know what the problem is? Leprechaun 2, clearly the leprechaun is a metaphor for men, you know, like sure. trying to possess teenage girls. But then Leprechaun 3, you're back to toddler. Don't take the leprechaun's toy or the leprechaun's going to freak out. It's the metaphor's all over the place.
But then, guys, then we go to space.
Yeah.
Okay. Resurfacing on an alien planet, the leprechaun abducts a member of the world's royalty, Princess Zarina, in an attempt to wed her and become the supreme ruler of space. Unfortunately for the diminutive schemer, I didn't write this, well-armed soldiers arrive to foil his plans. Not easily defeated, however, the feisty leprechaun continues to battle the warriors while also contending with the warp scientist known as Dr. Mittenhand. So dude, like I kind of want to watch this one.
You look like you had some things to say. So
I'm really excited. I'm excited by the premise of like Dune Leprechaun, you know.
It's basically what's amazing about this series, I mean, obviously they just give zero fucks about continuity or logic, and more power to them for it.
Yeah.
But to go from space to the hood, it's crazy. And then back to the hood. Anyway, yes. I don't know, guys. I'm going to give a synopsis of this film for our listeners who might not have seen
it. The synopsis of this film is Leprechaun. It's in the title.
No. Dan O'Grady steals 100 golden coins from a leprechaun played by Warwick Davis while on vacation in Ireland. The leprechaun follows him home, but Dan locks the murderous little person in a crate held at bay by a four-leaf clover. 10 years later, J.D. Redding and his daughter Tori, played by Jennifer Aniston, rent O'Grady's property for the summer. When their new neighbors accidentally release the leprechaun, he goes on a murderous rampage to reclaim his gold. Now, it needs to be said, Emily, we did tee this up in last week's episode, so it's worth saying here. Per IMDb, Leprechaun had some sort of screening or release in Battle Creek, Michigan on April 24th, 1992. I can't get any more information on it than that. That is why
probably a test screening.
Probably a test screening. That's why we're covering this film. Technically speaking, this film's theatrical release was on my birthday, January 8th, 1993.
What a special birthday for you.
It was.
I do want to just do a tight like 1 minute on IMDb's problems. IMDb starts in 1995. Basically, all records after 1995 are crystal clear. They're like, they'll be like, okay, this movie test screened in 1998, but it wasn't released until 2001. And that like, so the release date will be 2001. Before 1995, though, it's all user submitted. So it's a fucking free for all. So it's just like, oh, you know what? They made It's a Wonderful Life in 1912, but then they didn't release it until 1946. And you're like, I think that's wrong. And like, there are quality control editors who go through and clean this up, but there is stuff like they just don't care enough to be like, no, actually Leprechaun came out in 1993. They'll be like, yeah, I guess it screened one time in 1992 for an audience of 50 people who were all like, this movie needs more Leprechaun on like their little sheets. But like, yeah, that's my tight one on IMDb.
I like it.
When I was working at Vox, that was like, we were like, you can't really trust IMDb pre-1995. But that's a thing I think a lot of people don't know. So that's...
I mean, I'll be honest. I have been burned by IMDb in the past. Jude, we did a podcast, not Emily and I, but another co-host and I did a podcast on 1999 for like 5.5 years. And there were moments when I would just sort of cursory do kind of 1999, you know, deep dives on IMDb, and movies would pop up, to Emily's point, where they'd have screened in 1999 somewhere, but didn't actually get a release. And so it's happened.
Festivals especially. It's tricky because if it shows at a number of festivals, that'll make IMDb be like, oh, this is a 19. Like that happened just with Orlando, which showed at a bunch of festivals. And therefore, this is 1992.
I feel a little less like when it screens at a festival,
yeah, that's
I'm kind
less,
of like willing to give it its. But this, I don't know what the fuck this Battle Creek, Michigan thing is. I got burned by it. But Jude, what, did you see this film in the 90s or did you see this film for the first time for this?
I saw it for the first time like yesterday.
Perfect.
Yeah, it. I mean, for me, like Leprechaun was part of my cultural awareness. Like I say, there were always Leprechaun posters at like Blockbuster and the, you know, video rental section of the grocery store and whatever. But it was definitely portrayed to me as a serious and deathly horrifying film that I would perhaps never be old enough to watch.
Okay.
Coming into it now, I'm just like, it feels great. I feel like I've seen what the adults were keeping behind the curtain.
Yeah.
This is also a prime example, and we've talked about this a little bit, Emily. I think we might have dipped into this a little on our Hellraiser episode, but this movie comes out, it makes $8.6 million on $1 million budget in theaters, right? And then it makes an additional $15 million in VHS and DVD formats, right?
Yeah.
So like it's a big video hit, right? And horror back in the day, certainly in the like 80s and 90s, when you could do straight to video stuff for like nothing and you could build these franchises that would go on. It's just not really that, we don't really live in that world anymore, which is a little bit surprising to me on some level, because like you would think that streaming would do this more.
I think there is a level of prestige that even the lowest budget streaming films aim for that, sure, that like horror just can't hit, you know, like, right. Like it is a very weird thing that like Netflix has not tried to come up with its own weird slasher franchise. Right. They could totally do that. Yeah. My conception of this film, which I had not seen until yesterday, was like, this is a movie that people I knew watched at sleepovers and they weren't able to sleep because it was so scary.
Sure.
And
sure.
Like, sure. But
I guess I'm just sort of fascinated by this, exactly what you just said, Emily, this idea that this is beneath the streamers. And I got to be honest, it's not. The streamers are making a lot of garbage.
Like I'm totally fine. If Netflix wants a slasher franchise, I'll make them a fucking slasher franchise.
Do it.
I'll do that in a minute. It'll be
like a threat, but do it.
What's like a German thing I could do? I could be like, it's about like a bratwurst man. He's like, ah.
Sure.
Yeah, bratwurst is scary. Sausage is scary. Krampus, you've got Krampus. You know.
Yeah.
True. It feel just sort of interesting that like. I mean, I guess ultimately not to go down a rabbit hole, but we are in this weird slipstream right now where franchises and television series are kind of bleeding into one another. This idea that like your Marvel Cinematic Universe in so many ways is just like a very expensive television show. And, you know, you're getting into these sort of weird definitions of like what an ongoing series is. So to your point, Emily, like a slasher, it just feels obvious to me that like, why wouldn't Netflix want a fucking Freddy or a Jason? I don't know.
Yeah.
Why doesn't Shudder want that?
Exactly. Yeah.
And there are movies coming out now, like Censor, that are like, they're very clearly done as an homage to this particular aesthetic. I kind of want to like pack in, because I'm sensing Leprechaun skepticism among our panel, I want to pack in my unironic defense of Leprechaun, which is that this is like the decadent phase of slashers. Like nobody expected them to be good. They expected them to run for like 8 movies. Nobody would really watch them. They would, you know, come out direct to video. And you could just take the stupidest monster possible. Like, what is it? I guess it's a leprechaun. It's a sausage man. It's, you know, it's an evil beer hall. You know, it's, and just throw teenagers at it and it would be fine. And this movie is so clearly made with what I view as like the most charming part of that aesthetic, which is that like absolutely no one expected or even wanted it to be good. Like it's, it is like watching a child play a game. Like, yeah. Where, like, at one point, the leprechaun's like, I'm exactly 600 years old. And in the sequel, he's going to be over 1,000 years old and have a whole deal with his bride from exactly 1,000 years ago. And he can do telekinesis, or maybe he can just drive little cars. Or, you know, like, there's clearly a point where, like, they've subdued him with the four-leaf clover and are putting him in a box. And it's obviously a Cabbage Patch doll, and nobody wanted to hide the fact that it was a
Cabbage Patch doll. Don't question it.
Yeah,
Jennifer there's Aniston also nothing the less spiders. Threatening.
They're all full-blown tarantulas wandering around our basement, and like she comes out and she's like, "Oh my god, I can't believe that house!" And you know the hunk's like, "Why is it the spiders? Like the house is just famous for its spiders, apparently." Like sure. It's just like nobody put more than 3 seconds of thought into any decision the movie made, but every decision is just committed to with such vim and vigor that I just
I agree. I mean, the four-leaf clover being the perfect example of that. There's nothing less threatening than a four-leaf clover. It is a tiny little leaf that so this idea that it's supposed to, you know, have all this power is just sort of, you know.
I mean, like the thing, I mean, four-leaf clovers do supposedly bring you luck because they're extremely rare. So it is like, you know, I do love the scene where they're like digging through a patch of clover for four-leaf clover. It's, I think that like, I agree with everything you're saying, Jude, because like I had a blast with this movie. I think it is, I can't like in good conscience defend it, but like it's. Yeah, it does really remind me of this period of slashers, of horror movies, of being at a sleepover when you're 12 and somebody puts a movie like this on and it's not very good, but you're like, oh, like, I love that. Like, I don't have a lot of nostalgia. That's what this podcast is about. I don't care. I had a bad childhood, so I don't care about things. But like, I do have like weird nostalgia for this shit. Where it's just like, now we're in a house in North Dakota and there's a leprechaun here. And if they had wanted to make a sequel that was like Leprechaun Spider House and it was just about how there were spiders in this house, I would have watched that too. Like that's...
I hear that. And it's just, I'm trying to like imagine if I would have been scared. I'm sure I would have been scared by this at 12 or 10 or whatever.
Some of it's like the collective experience. You're with all your friends.
That's true.
And somebody gets scared. So everybody gets scared. And then it becomes a rolling ball of like, now everything is scary. Jude, do you have thoughts on this, of the sleepover experience?
Yeah, it's the light as a feather, stiff as a board thing. It's basically mass hypnosis. You're convincing yourself that Leprechaun is working as a movie, like as a group. But, you know, that I think when I was younger, you know, I found Friday the 13th scary at sleepovers. I didn't really understand, sure, you know, how goofy it was. I found Nightmare on Elm Street super scary, and I found it scary no matter how like ridiculously campy Freddy got, where he was like turning his victims into pizzas and eating them, you know, like it just, I think that, you know, for the value of what you're doing, which is a group activity, it's a Ouija board, you're just trying to creep each other out, you actually don't want it to be scary. You want Warwick Davis majestically in slow motion pogo sticking across the room toward his victim.
It's insane.
Phil, I know that your sleepovers at that age had a steady diet of legal dramas and erotic thrillers, but like, just judging from your nostalgia buttons, but
they weren't sleepovers. That's just what I would do by myself. I would just watch these things.
What? No, like, did you go to horror movie slumber parties, sleepovers, whatever? Like,
you know, the one that comes to mind that I think checks the box you're talking about. There was a sleepover that I went to where Gremlins was watched.
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. And that did not go well for young Phil. I didn't like that at all. I think I just went to sleep. I think I pretended to go to sleep and stopped watching. I was not built for that stuff as a kid.
That's okay.
I also just didn't like things turning into things.
Sure.
That was sort of a big, like, werewolves or what have, like, the leprechaun doesn't, he is a leprechaun. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, most of my sleepovers, I feel like, were more, like action movies or like, sure, Indiana, sure, sure, Jones. Like, it just less, yeah, less
I
horror.
Like, despite the fact that I grew up and everybody thought I was a boy, I spent a lot of time hanging out with girls and like watching. Sure. And then like I couldn't do the sleepover part, but I could like do the we're watching Leprechaun. Like we didn't watch Leprechaun, but we watched movies of that ilk. And then we would all freak each other out. But yeah, like when I went to boy sleepovers, it was all like Ninja Turtles and shit. And then everyone would be like, everyone would be like, I'm Donatello. And I'd be like, I'm reporter April O'Neil. Hi, how are you?
So I do want to just give a brief overview of how this film was received critically, Emily. I don't know if you looked into some of the contemporaneous reviews.
I did not,
of
because I feel like that's you know what, it would only ruin my enjoyment of life.
That's fair. Yeah. So the Austin Chronicle called it. Sorry, Jude, I didn't mean to talk over you. What was that?
Sorry, I talked over you. I'm exile me.
Oh, stop. The Austin Chronicle called it cliched, uninteresting, and an utter waste of perfectly good Kodak film stock. The Chicago Tribune wrote that the film brought new meaning to the term bad. The Washington Post described the characters as a group of morons who act like flunked kindergarten, but said that Aniston, quote unquote, might be competent in a better film. But then the film was sort of reappraised to some degree in 93. Where a critic, Luke Y. Thompson, said the perfect high concept comedy slasher and is still Jennifer Aniston's best film to date, which is shots fired.
Do I agree with that? I don't think that I do.
I do not.
But I think it might be in the top five. Honestly,
it might. She actually gets out of this unscathed. Yes. Like I actually think that Jennifer Aniston is unquestionably
her.
Her and Warwick know what movie they're in.
Her role in this movie is hot teenager, and she does a great job with it. Like the hot teenager who saves the day, which she's basically the final girl, which is weird because I think she's the only girl. But,
correct.
But yeah, it is like, you can see why the next year, the year after this, she makes Friends and becomes a mega star. But and I think this is the last time she ever played a teenager. Yep. Has she ever been asked about Leprechaun? I feel like
many times.
Oh, great.
And she, so this was because I did a little bit of research on this. And this was one of those things where, so you said Friends is the next year, right?
Yeah.
And 94. This movie gets a big boost retroactively in video sales and rentals because of Friends, right? So there is kind of, they're riding her coattails a little bit. And she's been kind of denigrating to this film over the years. And then Warwick Davis starts to speak out and say, like, essentially, like, come on, Jennifer, like, what do you, why? We all knew what we were doing. We were doing a kind of cheesy horror film. And like, you know, everyone does. There's lots of actors that have done soap operas, lots of actors that have done shit they don't love. And she kind of came around on it. And then she watched it when she was dating Justin Theroux. They watched it together. And she was just like, yeah, it's kind of fun. But to your point, Emily, you're watching this movie and you're like, she's got the juice. You know what I mean? Like, you know that this is a person who the camera not only loves her, but like she's so comfortable and so watchable. And like, she's making this whole thing a lot more palatable. And I think that had they gone with, I know that the director wanted like a hot blonde and they talked about dyeing her hair and blah, blah, blah. Like if they had just gone with some quote unquote scream queen, I think this movie would have been far lesser for it.
I mean, Aniston and Davis both have kind of that star quality where you want to watch what they're doing. And but also it is greatly enhanced by the fact that every other actor in this movie is like, here's like a weird clown. Here's the world's worst child. It's just like, and like they're, it's not like they're, I don't want to say they're bad actors. It's that they're playing characters that are barely conceived. And most actors will like not be able to do that. Warwick Davis is like really great at like, I'm going to turn this into what I want it to be. And Jennifer Aniston just has that quality where you're like, yeah, I want to watch her do things. I want to watch her like get bit by a leprechaun.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, to counter this, like I just watched Cutting Class, which is the Brad Pitt bad slasher.
Oh, interesting.
And it's definitely like a terrible slasher movie that has Brad Pitt in it as like a hot jock. And at the same time, it doesn't cohere for me on the level the Leprechaun does. You can't just put a star in one of these things. You have to have like the appropriate juice behind like just let's not try to make a good movie. Let's try to make Leprechaun. You didn't come to see good. You came to see this.
A very similar thing happened with I think it's Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, because Renee Zellweger's in that before she blows up. And so people were like, well, maybe this will be like Leprechaun blew up after Aniston. But Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 is not a very good movie. And like Zellweger's good in it, but you're also like, there is something in Leprechaun that captures a certain experience of watching a good bad slasher that I think is like again, to me, is just so intently, I'm hanging out with the gals and we're watching a leprechaun kill people. And I'm so happy to be accepted.
You know, it is interesting because I do think, so the director of this film, Mark Robert Jones, who would be a producer on Leprechaun 2 and then writes and directs a film in 95 called Rumpelstiltskin. Feels like he's going back to the well a little bit of horrific little people.
Sure.
He makes Rumpelstiltskin in 95, and I have not seen Rumpelstiltskin. Have you seen it, Emily?
I've never even heard of it. I'm looking this guy up. I gotta see his career.
So Rumpelstiltskin gets greenlit, and that's why he doesn't write and direct Leprechaun 2. Rumpelstiltskin is 87 minutes with credits, had a budget of $3 million, and it made only $300,000 in 54 theaters. So this Rumpelstiltskin did not set the world on fire.
I love that he's made a series of clearly just like bad horror movies, one of which got turned into a TV series for some reason. And then he stops, and then his most recent credit is an episode of the PBS series Nature. He just was like, maybe I'll make a nature documentary now. Like,
I mean, I'm into it. But I do think, though, to your point, Jude, that there is he's trying to do a thing here, right? Like, this is not, as is the case with so many films, I think it's very easy for us as, you know, cinephiles or what have you, to be dismissive of movies that are bad or that just don't work, right? But there's intent, and there's intent behind this film. I can't speak to the rest of the Leprechaun series, but it does feel as though he's going for a thing with this movie. And I think that the childlike stuff works, but also works against it. It's weird. It's like it's doing two things, right? Like it's taking away the scariness of the Leprechaun, but it is adding to the kind of campiness of it. So it's working, because like I agree with Warwick Davis that like I don't know that you could really make this a full-throated horror movie.
Yeah.
And I mean, a lot of the intentional comedy is just deeply strange and uncomfortable, Emily. Like a lot of it revolves around who I will just refer to as Francis from Pee-wee's Big Adventure, but he's like playing a developmentally disabled man who needs the leprechaun's gold so he can get an operation to become smart. Like, and it's just like, it's really
not great.
It's fun that the movie sort of committed to, you know, maybe facing hate crime legislation on two fronts there. Where like, if the Irish don't get us the disabled will, we're gonna run for both fences. But it's really hard to watch whenever the movie slows down.
Yesterday, Jude, you emailed me and you wrote, Leprechaun is the greatest movie I've ever seen in my life. And also, I'm pretty sure a hate crime. Thank you so much for including me in this journey. And that was like, I was like thinking that when you said that you were just like, oh, this is a hateful against the Irish. And I was prepared for that. I was not prepared for Ollie, who is, I don't know. Like the thing that they do that is very 1990s is they don't specify any sort of thing. They're just like, he's a little bit dumb, but like it's coded in a way where you're supposed to read him as developmentally disabled. So that's like the 90s thing they do, is like, well, we know we can no longer specifically say, you know, the condition this person lives with, because that's demonizing them, but we can like really hint at it, right? That's fine. No one's gonna get mad at us for that.
It is strange because like it doesn't really serve a purpose in this movie, and I don't mean it on terms of a character level, on a plot level either. It's just sort of like he eats a piece of gold and that creates pandemonium.
I think they're trying to reverse the roles of the kid is kind of a piece of shit. Normally in a movie like this, the kid would be like the character who's the innocent, the naive, who's constantly in trouble. Now it's an adult man. you know, who has swallowed a gold coin and the leprechaun's chasing him around. And like, to get to that, I guess the shortest route they saw was we're going to make him, you know, developmentally disabled. And it's just like, okay, maybe there could have been like, you know, somebody cooked the gold into a burger he was eating. I don't know. That's a bad pitch, but like, you go with me here.
No, I hear you. No, sure. Yeah. You know, it's interesting because like, I don't know. I mean, we might cover it because it did technically come out in 1992, but the Of Mice and Men movie that came out in 1992.
Jesus. Let's not do that. Let's make this. Let's just make this a podcast about the Leprechaun franchise.
Okay,
let's
great.
Go
sure.
deep.
Well, I don't know that we're going to cover the movie just because we don't need to. And also, that's a book that we all had to read in high school. I'm assuming you guys did, or maybe not.
I have never read it. I read Grapes of Wrath. Like that was the right. And like, I know Mice and Men from its cultural reputation. And like, I'm sure I like Steinbeck. Maybe I'll read it someday.
It's a good book. I quite liked the book. And then in class, as is, you know, most teachers want, they can also put you in front of a TV screen and make you watch the movie as well, so that, you know, they don't have to teach you for two periods, but which is fine. That sort of dynamic, that 90s, and I put this in quotation marks, that like simple thing that they like to play with, this idea of like dumb against big heartedness, like all these things that they kind of like to put into kind of this, you know, basket, is a very 90s thing, which we obviously don't do anymore. But usually it's put in the movie as a mirror, you know, as a way for another character to learn something about themselves or to grow or whatever the case might be. Not in this movie. In this movie, we got to see him get attacked by a leprechaun and almost eviscerated by him.
Well, the journey is that the kid decides that he prefers Ollie to the leprechaun. The kid is like, the kid is fair. Shitty to Ollie. And then the kid is sure. like, but I don't want you to get eaten by a leprechaun. So that's
a growth. That's an arc.
That's an arc. It's a two beat arc, which is not great, but it's like, you know, good for you, leprechaun. You did it. I just looked up this Of Mice and Men movie.
Yes.
Played at Cannes. It played at Cannes. It was Gary Sinise's second film in competition at Cannes.
It's Malkovich. It's Malkovich and Gary Sinise.
Ray Walston, who I love.
What is the name of their fucking theater troupe that they were both in?
Oh, Steppenwolf?
Yeah.
Like the thing is, Sinise, I don't know if Malkovich was in this, but Sinise is in this 1990 Chicago Steppenwolf production of Grapes of Wrath. That then moves to Broadway and wins a bunch of Tonys, is a fucking brilliant play, a fucking brilliant example of how to adapt something for the stage. So I'm sure Sinise was like on a Steinbeck high, and he like evidently had read Of Mice and Men in high school, and just like it changed the way he saw the world. So then he makes a movie that I don't think people have thought about since it played at Cannes. Like it came out after it played at Cannes. I don't think people thought about it then.
Who directed it? Is it anyone of note?
Gary Sinise.
Oh shit. I didn't know he directed it.
It's his second film, and both his first two films got in the can.
Here's the thing. There's many reasons for us not to cover Of Mice and Men, which is why we will not cover Of Mice and Men. One of them being Gary Sinise. I do not want to do a deep dive into Gary Sinise and all of the things that are not great about Gary Sinise. He's like a fucking, you know, tried and true, dyed in the wool Republican human.
Now is he one of the like Hollywood Republicans who's like, yes, I'm a Republican and I want no one to take any of my money, but Donald Trump I cannot abide? Or is he like a John Voight?
I don't know that he's full John Voight. I can just say that I know people who have crossed paths with him professionally, mm-hmm. and he's just like he's tough to deal with. And yeah. It's just like, and he's big into like funding all sorts of, you know, I don't know if he's Sound of Freedom Gary Sinise, but it just feels like it's not great. It's not a great look, and I don't really want to dive into it. It's also to sort of come back to what we were saying in terms of Leprechaun, there is just sort of this.
I like how you're pivoting.
I'm trying, but it's, I do think that the dumb moniker, the kind of like, you know, however they want to deal with it in the 90s is not great. It's problematic. it's offensive. I'll say that in Leprechaun, though, like, they don't go full tilt, if that's, like, there are far worse movies in the 90s that play inside this terrible sandbox. So I'm giving Leprechaun some points for that, for what it's worth.
The thing about this movie is it's trying to do all the slasher tropes of teenagers, but it's like they're all different ages. Yeah. Like Ollie's clearly like in his late 20s, early 30s, somewhere in there.
Sure. But
like there is always the guy in the group of friends in the slasher who's like a little bit dim, but good hearted, you know, like, and in the most, you know, when it's a teenager, that doesn't play as readily as like, this person is has a mental health issue as it does here. Jude, I'm curious for your thoughts on how this film appropriates teenage tropes and like just gives them to a bunch of adults randomly.
Yeah, it's not clear to me. Like, I thought Jennifer Aniston was supposed to be like 29 because she didn't have a relationship with her father. Like, she showed up at his house and was like, I've never met you before. Where are we? What state are we in? Like, she's... And I mean, this is another thing where like when you love, it's like that Steve Albini quote about how like the distortion or the bad part of an art form always becomes its signature. I love that teenagers in slasher movies don't really belong to any recognizable developmental phase and they never have any relationships with their parents. Like they're just basically like adults who go to school. But yeah, her father disappears. I think they're trying to do worldly wise child with, as you rightfully note, the piece of shit. But it comes off way too hard where like the child is like having graphic murder fantasies about blowing people's brains out.
True.
And, true. You know, Ollie in that mix is just, it's another case of like you wanted to do an archetype and you just, you came at it too hard and sort of flattened it. And it's just like, it's a really hard, like drunk karaoke off key rendition of the archetype.
I feel
what the song was supposed to be, but it's not that song.
It's also like the two guys she would be in a love triangle with in a normal movie are the hunk guy, which of course, and then her dad. It's like they've turned the other guy into her dad, so like there's no, like obviously there's no romantic or sexual tension there. It's just like that type is now a man in his 50s. Like it's very strange.
Well, I don't even really like remember her dad. I remember him in the beginning.
He gets bit by the leprechaun and then kind of leaves the movie.
Is that what happens? Because I can't remember.
The leprechaun pretends to be a cat.
The escalating series though of like the leprechaun's various actions being blamed on animals. Like, oh no, it was a rat. Oh no, it was a mouse. Oh no, it was a spider. Oh no, it was a cat. Oh, that was a bear. Like, but at some point the leprechaun does impersonate a cat and hide in a tree. The leprechaun announces himself by like doing people noises from inside implausibly small spaces a lot.
Also, the leprechaun, like, he uses a bear trap at one point.
Yes.
He does do, it's very strange because like I don't feel like any of his, he doesn't have any weapons. It's weird. It's like he's got apparently like superhuman strength and like claws. It's like he fucks up people's faces. But like they never really give him a weapon of any sort. I mean, a pogo stick doesn't count. Like,
you've clearly not played enough Dungeons and Dragons. You don't need weapons. If you've got magic, you could just keep throwing magic spells at
people. But he's not doing that, is my point. He's not doing that either.
Well, he doesn't need to. He's just inherently magic and he can bite really hard.
But also he does get shot and he bleeds green.
Yeah.
As all Irish people do, is what I'm told. They all bleed green.
He has the green skeleton. I appreciated that they dug into the medical science for that.
Yeah.
They wanted to respect.
Like an alien in the X-Files series. It's important thing.
I will say that I'm trying to remember the order of events here, but he does melt at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And that looked fucking cool.
That was great. They spent a lot of money on that. Like that was like we got the budget. And then he goes in the well, but then he crawls out of the well as a skeleton. That also looks pretty cool.
And he headbutts him with a gun.
Yeah.
Like he just butts him with a gun.
He falls back in and then they blow up a well.
Oh, it's the wad of gum. Right. So it's the wad of gum with the four-leaf clover that makes him melt.
Yeah.
And then they pour gasoline into the well. They blow up the well. And then you still hear his VO at the end, so he's not dead.
No, he's still reciting little rhymes about how he traded his soul for his gold. Like, he's gonna be back. This is a fun time.
I have notes that I'm kind of going through here. He rides a lot of kids' vehicles.
Yeah. That's part of his charm.
He rides a tricycle. He has part of his charm. He rides a go-kart. you have this shoe shine scene where he's just shining shoes, and then they later are able to sort of slow him down by throwing dirty shoes at him that he has no choice but to shine.
Listen.
No, Emily, you listen.
That's the thing I love about folklore, though, where you're just like this, it's like this character. It's like a boss monster in a video game. It's like this character has this one weak point, and instead of we give him shoes, he has to shine them. I love that shit. It's so funny.
Yeah. I do feel that they could have explained like the leprechaun is a trickster spirit. And at that point, him just having a bear trap could be like the classic trickster move. But as it is, it just seems like he's like a really resourceful improviser a lot. Like
you kind of just hit the nail on the head for me, which is that this movie has a real lack of rules. Yeah. I don't understand the rules of the leprechaun. If he's a spirit, a magical spirit of sorts, then I can ride with that, right? Because then it feels almost like the dream logic of Freddy, right? Where it's like he can kind of do whatever, and that's what makes him scary. But the leprechaun seems to be a corporeal being of sorts. He's tactile and terrestrial, and yet sometimes he is and sometimes he's not. There's a real kind of lack of guardrails on this thing. And I know that might be part of his charm, as Emily says, but it leads to a somewhat unengaging theatrical experience.
I think you have a point about the film Leprechaun and its presentation of leprechauns and how probably a slasher needs to have rules. But I do like, I invited Jude on because they are, a horror movie person. And also but I do like, I realized as we're
when
having,
I texted Emily and I was like, we need to find a guest for Leprechaun. And you're like, I think we can do this. And I was like, and then just like, all right.
But I realizing as we talk about this, your comic Neighbors is very much about this kind of folklore thing where you don't entirely understand the rules. And Neighbors, I want to be clear, much scarier, much better experience than Leprechaun. But like, I am interested in you because you've talked with me a lot about this, like this, like, tradition of these people who live alongside people and you can't quite understand them and like their rules are strange to you, because I think that plays into this mythos if it doesn't play into Leprechaun itself.
Yeah, like I mean, I think that ideally, like a fairy or indeed a leprechaun is scary precisely because these are old stories, and all of the stories are just like, look, they are vicious. They do things for reasons we don't understand. We don't know what they are or why they are. But here's just this collection of stuff we've come up with down the years that seems to sort of work. Iron seems to work. Salt works. They don't like bread for whatever reason. Carry bread in your pocket. Turn your shirt inside out. You know, like it should be, you should be dealing with a threat that is to some degree incomprehensible. But I feel like Warwick Davis is very comprehensible in this mm-hmm. where like, I mean, he's just sort of like got ADHD, where like early in the movie, he's like, "Arr, I don't have me full powers." And then later he's like, "Arr, I have my full powers," and proceeds to do exactly the same things. Like you're like, oh, he's going to level up, and he does not level up. He's just like, good, they're back. I'm going to proceed running around for various cabinets.
Are there movies that you find capture that sense of like, we don't understand how to deal with these creatures? They just kind of live here, like, and we can't comprehend them.
Yeah, I think there are
Critters
like that. I really liked Vivarium, as you know. I thought that that had a lot of that in it. I feel like there's a lot of like cosmic horror. There's a lot of David Lynch, you know, stuff that sure. captures that feeling of like, I live right next door to a universe where things just like don't work the way they should and yeah. door can open and I can step into it at any time.
It actually like brings me back to mind of The Empty Man, which is like that movie does end up sort of explaining some of what's going on, but you get the explanation and you're like, I understand less now. Like it's and that is such a hard tone to pull off in film. I think in literature, you can pull it off a little bit more readily just because, you know, you have access to people's inner monologues. But when a movie pulls it off, that generally is like one of my faves. So.
Sorry, go ahead, Jude. I didn't mean to.
But no, I think the not making sense has to, you have to commit to it all or none. Like Warwick Davis should either be profoundly incomprehensible or he should be like hiding in people's suitcases singing creepy nursery rhymes. And, you know, uh-huh, uh-huh. like as it is, he knows he's a horror villain a little bit too clearly. And it's like never really clear. He just sort of goes back and forth between like slasher tactics and incomprehensible spirit world tactics, just sort of depending on vibes, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I do think like that is the thing that film does, is it literalizes things.
Yeah.
And like to work against that is very difficult. And you have to be a Lynch or a Hayao Miyazaki or somebody who's like deliberately like figuring out a way to work against it. And generally, like you, like if this had gone all the way into being like, this is a leprechaun, there's three rules, don't feed him after midnight, don't get him wet, blah, blah, blah. Like that would have been great. But it's also, you know, it's not, it tries to ride the line in between. And I do think that is, it's great failing as a movie in this genre.
Well, I think... I need to be a little more critical of Leprechaun here, just in the sense that like
Phil, I want to be clear to you. Like you can hate Leprechaun all you want. This is a safe space.
I appreciate that. I am not convinced that this movie is attempting a Lynchian level.
I don't think it is.
You know, rulelessness, if you will.
To be clear, it's built atop myths that attempt that. And therefore, I do think that like the movie is just throwing in everything it's ever heard about leprechauns, but it's trying to make them too concrete in a way that makes it seem like, you know, you should be able to like sit down with this guy and be like, what's your deal? And he'll be like, I love me gold. And also, you know, if you throw a shoe at me, I'll shine it because my father was a shoe shine. And like then there's like a flashback to like Dublin. And...
It's just, I agree. It's. I feel like I can't really. I'm wrestling with this notion of.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Intent and laziness, right?
Intent. What if laziness is the intent, though?
Which very well might be. I just, there's a part of me that feels like it's it's got some bearing walls and some sort of rails that it's kind of dealing with in terms of the myths you're talking about, Emily, and in terms of the things that it knows that people know about leprechauns. So it wants to kind of give you that ballast to hold on to. But then it also doesn't really care about telling a story properly.
I want to be clear. Everyone on this call could write a better movie than the script of this movie. To one of Jude's earlier points, I do think to a certain degree, a good script is incidental to the pleasures of a fun slasher movie.
Totally.
Obviously, a Scream, A Nightmare on Elm Street, where the script is good and the direction is good and the acting is good, like those are next level. Halloween, obviously, the other great example. But like, the slasher is based so much on the constant emotional release of another person gets hurt, another person gets killed, sure, that you can kind of half-ass it in all departments as long as like the monster is kind of fun.
Yeah. And I think what's charming about this movie and what's frustrating about this movie is that it really feels like watching someone write the first draft of the script in real time. Like it'll pick up motifs and then throw them away. You know, traded me soul for me gold is clearly supposed to set up like Jennifer Aniston needs to learn to value people over money, but then they just forget about it. And then she just has to like dig through a four-leaf clover patch and believe in something, some unspecified thing.
It's kind of like the Polar Express.
The movie has a totally coherent premise where it's like a man has accidentally brought home a leprechaun from the old world, bringing gold home, and oh no, now it's out to get him. And then it just sort of runs out of that story 10 minutes in and is like, title card 10 years later, and just starts a different movie. Like there's just really the sense of watching someone just sort of run at the story and not revisit any decision. And that's why it's chaotic. And it can be fun to watch someone or many someones in this case go through that process. But if you want a satisfying story at the end of it, it's not going to deliver.
And I think the reason I think of these as sleepover movies is when you're 11, 12, you feel ready for more adult storytelling, but your brain is still kind of child chaotic. You haven't quite hit adolescence when your brain's going to start to even out. So like a movie like this feels so good because it feels adult because there's violence and sometimes boobs, but also the chaos of it is so similar to like how you perceive, you know, when you listen to a kid play games or tell a story, a kid's just like, and then the duck comes over here and the duck is got laser eyes and that means that the bear has to go to jail, and you're like, what? And it's like, they're like, well, the duck is a cop, and you're like, oh well, we need to have a discussion about this. So
see, now it's starting to sound like Toys.
I mean, a movie that genuinely I was like, if I give Leprechaun a higher score than Toys, will Phil send me into the sun. So I'm going to give it a lower score, but know that in my heart, it was a thing I thought about.
Don't even say it. I know what you're saying, though. It does feel, it has that, I mean, do you remember the notorious way that M. Night Shyamalan wrote Lady in the Water was by telling his kids stories at bedtime, right? And sort of just kind of going along with the things that they were asking and sort of this sort of stream of consciousness kind of thing, which leads to a perfect movie, no notes, I'm kidding, Lady in the Water, not great. But similar vibe to this in terms of feeling almost like it's piecemeal together.
I do think like there are these there's this famous thing of like Peter Pan starts as stories told to someone, you know, which is why it feels so random. I think Alice in Wonderland did too. Watership Down, one of my favorite books of all time, really started out as this guy was telling his daughters, they were like, they wanted to hear some stories about rabbits. And so like this whole thing comes out of that.
That he killed them all.
Yeah. Well, no, listen, that's important. Rabbits die. I do think that like this, there's this sort of this idea that this is, that like, this is a way you can tell a story, but I feel like if you know too much about storytelling, it kind of doesn't work. And I do think M. Night Shyamalan, for all his faults, knows a lot about how stories are supposed to work. So like, he's trying to impose a narrative on a thing that should inherently be a little bit narrative less. You have to be in a space where you know enough about stories to like construct a basic plot, but know so little that you like kind of don't know anything else. And like,
no, for sure. I do think that one of the things that this movie is attempting, and I think is sort of unfortunately failing at a little bit, is it's also kind of a fable fairy tale, right? Like, it's also sort of baked into this because, spoiler, leprechauns aren't real. I think you're thinking
like all the characters in the movie Leprechaun, and that is what caused most of the trouble in that movie.
I mean,
Phil, how long would it take you to come around on a leprechaun is real?
To manifest and try to kill me, I'd be like, apparently leprechauns are real now. I don't know what to say.
But how, if it hid in the shadows and made noises like a cat, and like all the like, if I was like, Phil, that's a leprechaun, there's a leprechaun after us, and you were like, no, it's just, would you be like, no, it's just a cat until the third act, is what I'm asking.
That's, I want to be very clear, that is not the case with Jennifer Aniston in this movie. She sees this leprechaun many times. I don't know, until I saw it I'd probably question it, and then if I saw it I'd be like, oh fuck, there's a leprechaun.
It's good we have a doubting Thomas on this podcast. That's important to our to our vibe.
I just think that I, and again I'm curious as to your thoughts on this, Jude, and obviously you you're both much more, you know, understand horror movies better than I do, but you don't see a ton of horror movies that don't exist in our universe, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think part of the scare of horror films is that it exists in our world, right? Like, that's what makes it scary. So if this was a fable of sorts, or if this leaned into the fable fairy tale component of leprechauns, I think it would also reduce its scare factor. Is that a fair assessment?
Maybe. Yeah. I am thinking about this. Like, I do think like horror often is, it's like Lovecraftian cosmic horror, which we've talked about a few times, very much is like, I'm a guy and I moved to a town. Oh no, there's tentacled sea beasts and they're ancient gods and they're going to kill all of us. It's like, so yeah, I do think like it does need, you do need to start from like a recognizable experience in some capacity. You know, like how the Hotel Transylvania movies are about having a hotel. Like, that is, you know, I don't know why that was my poll.
Yeah, I was like, why that? But okay.
But it's, yeah, it is. I do think like this movie starts with a series of like kind of coherent conflicts. I am moving to a new town where I don't know anybody and it's nothing like L.A. I love having fancy things and cool friends and cool cars. Like, that's all on a human level. That's all recognizable.
The handyman is hot.
Yeah, the handyman is hot. Also, there's a child and like a weird clown man, and they're painting my house. And like, there is the quick fucking rewrite of this. That's like, it's about this dad and this daughter's relationship, and a leprechaun gets in between them. Just immediately fixes so many problems.
I mean, it does though. Like, I'm just just fascinating to me that like, I think the three of us understand that very sort of somewhat obvious and easy fixes to this could have gone a long way towards this being like a much better horror movie, right? Like, it's existing in a weird space that I think is, you know, commendable, but also doesn't totally work.
I think to our point, however, you can be a C-minus horror movie and go a long way. You can be a C-minus slasher, and that will, like, there's like, you're a C-minus slasher, you're kind of in like the top third. Because there's so many movies that are so much worse. And I do think that's what Leprechaun tapped into, is like, it is, you know, that there are elements of it that are so compelling and fun, mostly in Davis and Aniston's performances. But like, you know, also, you know, there's like some good gags in it. It's
sure.
Yeah.
It's not an irredeemable movie. I'm as we continue to talk about it, I feel like there was just a... Shockingly, I'm going to say there was a lot of potential in the Leprechaun movie. Awesome. And yet I feel like some of it is not, you know, attained.
I think
you say that there's a lot of gold hidden. Yeah.
They could have mined some more gold.
For that gold, and you're a little bit enraged that you can't find it.
I'm a little bit enraged. And if I'm being completely honest, I wanted more rainbows.
Yeah. The big ass go. Cartoon rainbow is a really powerful addition.
That was so fun. Was so
I just kind of wish that like there was a way to sort of weaponize a rainbow against him. Do you know what I'm saying? Sure.
Like if you're going to do just, them. Yeah.
You know, the, right?
Right. If the
like a Care Bear stare sort of situation.
Ooh. Let's get the Care Bear. Let's okay. Leprechauns versus Care Bears. That would is watch. A franchise starter. Bill, I think you need to reboot Leprechaun. I think that you.
It's been done.
It needs to happen again. Hollywood's got franchise fever. You need to figure out a way to make it about trauma. And I think we're on the rails here.
Care Bears versus kind of anything. It's honestly a franchise.
I think that like an obvious
Alien versus Care Bears,
an obvious comparison point for this film that is a lot better in this same basic space is Child's Play.
Chucky is everything
that they kind of want the Leprechaun to be, and like Chucky has continued to be, because I think the same guy has continued to be in charge of Chucky. The recent TV show was also him. I do think like a Leprechaun TV show could be fun. I think that's what I'm saying. I think it's time to do a Leprechaun TV show that's all about trauma.
What if John Crowley decided that that was what he was going to do next?
Ooh, yeah, that'd be great. Good for him.
Get Saoirse Ronan in there.
Listen, I bet she'd do it.
Maybe he's not actually a leprechaun. Maybe he's just, you know, badly damaged because of the intergenerational trauma of the potato famine and colonialism.
Interesting. And he's
like, I am going to embody the wounded spirit of my people, who, as we all know, is a leprechaun. Mm-hmm. And it's there's like a strong political subtext there.
Could he have a potato gun?
I doubt that they would let you make it if you didn't give him one.
Yeah. This is good. We're cooking with gas here.
We're really cooking with Irish gas. I mean, it is the irony here is that there is a pretty deep well of stuff to be done with the leprechaun.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of a leprechaun. I just don't think they mine it is the funny thing. Like, I think that if you look at this series and you look at where they go with it, it just seems to be, wouldn't it be funny if ... Leprechaun was in ... place? Like, it just doesn't seem to be particularly thoughtful.
You know how the Alien franchise is always like, when are the aliens going to get to Earth? And you also know that the second the aliens get to Earth, everything's going to fall apart even more than that franchise already has.
Yeah.
I do feel like that the Leprechaun movies are that, but with Ireland. They're just like, that Leprechaun's got to get back. And like, but no, the second he's there, it's just like, it's all done, you know?
Well, because then he's just
Leprechaun society. What if he immigrated because he's burned too many bridges back there?
What if he's like the doctor? So he's just like traveling. Sure. All the other Leprechauns are dead, or he thinks they are. Listen,
right. It's like Kung Fu the series, but with a leprechaun. He just travels around America.
Oh, Bill, let's pitch this. Like, the thing is, nobody can sell anything right now, but I bet we could sell a leprechaun version of like the Incredible Hulk show.
It is sort of fascinating to me when I hit play on this, knowing very little about Leprechaun outside of the poster, honestly. Like, I worked at many video stores, you know, as a kid, whenever you're in the horror section, you're seeing these images that are kind of burning your brain a little bit. Critters was one that always stayed with me. Him coming out of the toilet. I was always like, they're in the toilets now. Like, that's a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't know very much about it. And then when I hit press play, the first thing you see is him in a cave. The leprechaun's in a cave. He's got his pot of gold and he's got a rainbow behind him. And I was just like, maybe I do know everything I need to know about leprechauns. And then this movie just proceeded to kind of illustrate to me that they're not interested really in doing much mining, really much of this mythology.
The scariest thing about the Critters poster is that when you are using the bathroom and your toddler finds you in there, that's the worst, because they're just like, that's like the one place you can get away from them. Sometimes eventually they figure out how to open doors. Mine hasn't,
like raptors,
but I'm told it's gonna happen. Jude, I'm sorry I cut you off.
No, I mean, I think that this really suffers for being written in a pre-Wikipedia universe, because it's trying to summon the folklore. Like when he comes up with a big steaming pot of tea, like, oh, the little people have our magical ways. You're like, yes, tell me more about them. And it's like they ran out of research at that exact point, you know, and just had to sort of BS the rest of the way through it. They take it for granted that you find the concept of the leprechaun funny and charming, and that they can just throw a leprechaun at you in a variety of situations. And I don't think so. I think that you need to earn your leprechaun. Although again, this worked for me. I don't know how many more times it would work for me, but I have to imagine that nobody's ever really watched more than 1.5 leprechaun movies. Like your first one has always got to be your, oh my God, they actually did this. And then by the second one, you probably run out of steam.
You know, I really hope they cover this on Blink Check's Patreon. They do the Leprechaun series.
That's what's important to announce, that because this is a 93 movie and we've covered it in a 92 miniseries, whatever miniseries we're doing going forward, in St. Patrick's Day, we're going to cover a Leprechaun movie until we've gone through all 8. I think that when we get to In the Hood, we're going to be sad about this, because I'm guessing those movies are quite racist. But, it's a thing we've committed to. It's a thing that we've committed. We've been cursed to do. Yes, it is a thing. Because if we don't, the Leprechaun will find you, Phil.
I do think that the moment in this when Jennifer Aniston's on the phone and the little leprechaun hand comes out of the receiver.
it's a Nightmare on Elm Street scare. It's like a really absolutely classic one, that with Freddy's tongue coming out of the phone. They do that. They do the melting leprechaun. I'm sad to say, is the end of Child's Play. Like at a certain point, they know what they're riffing on, and they're just like throwing in bits from other movies. But I prefer to see it as homage, much like America is a melting pot where the Irish Americans have found acceptance and validation of their cultural traditions. The movie Leprechaun is a melting pot where bits and pieces of other movies that you probably liked a little bit more will just show up and be validated for what they are.
Put America the Beautiful under that? Just
sure. Yeah. And then a more, you know.
Yeah.
There's a scene in this where Jennifer Aniston's in a cop car. And she uses a nightstick and jams it into the leprechaun's eye. And then he kills the cop and he steals his eye, the dead cop's eye, and puts it back in his eye socket. Gross, awful, and marginally illogical. But,
listen,
a good moment.
A great moment. I do think, like, one thing, Libby and I wrote a script that was sort of steeped in fairy lore, and we spent a lot of time researching fairy lore only to find that anything you want a fairy to do, you can find some example of it in some culture. And it was just like, we kind of had to be like, we want them to be incomprehensible just a little bit, but also like, we kind of need to, like, we need to know the rules of this. It is this thing of like, you want the leprechaun to be able to stick a hand out of the phone. You can probably find like a thing that suggests the leprechaun could do that in a myth somewhere. But it's just like, I do think that the thing that sets, again, like Lynch and Miyazaki apart, and we've talked about this on the show, from a lot of other filmmakers of that ilk, is they know the rules they're operating in on some level, even if it's just instinctive. And like, the audience doesn't need to know those rules, but as long as somebody does, the story can sort of be coherent. This movie, you know, struggles with that concept, to be polite to it. Great film.
I know what you're saying, that this movie is, I actually think that this movie does have aspirations of sorts. I mean, I do think that the filmmaker is, I mean, he talked in the research that I did, you know, he talked about how Critters was, you know, he really was going to do something a lot more horror bent. And I'm curious as to what that is. My assumption is that it's probably closer to what Rumpelstiltskin ended up being, just in terms of, pure horror.
Yeah.
But I stand by what I think what we're all saying, which is that what Warwick Davis is bringing to this, and that sort of Freddy, Chucky kind of vibe is what makes it pop at all. Like, if this was a straight up horror movie with just a leprechaun just terrorizing people, I don't know that it really makes any impact.
Yeah.
But, yeah. You know.
Like, that's why I'm dreading the reboots, because I don't think that we need a grounded, gritty leprechaun franchise. Like, I think this is something that could only exist in a very particular moment where people knew these movies would make money and they knew that critics wouldn't like them, and they could just sort of operate on the understanding that,
sure,
this is going to be a piece of shit, but can we have fun? Can we have a scene where somebody is stuck in a bear trap and people are just finding increasingly implausible objects on the ground to beat a leprechaun with? Uh-huh. You know, like, why not?
Why not? Why not, indeed?
My question for the panel is, is this the most famous movie set in North Dakota? Because Fargo, famously, despite being named after a city in North Dakota, like 95% of that is set in Minnesota. I don't think it counts. So I think the next one on the list is Leprechaun.
Where is
it? It's definitely very high.
Is that Montana?
Wyoming.
Wyoming. Ah, damn.
I am looking at movies in North Dakota right now, Emily, and it's slim pickings.
Listen, the thing is, like, my home state, South Dakota, has even fewer. Because I think if you're like, I got to set a movie in a Dakota, you go to North Dakota first, and you just assume they're the same.
Well, but South Dakota has North by Northwest.
South Dakota has North by Northwest and Dances with Wolves. So it's got, like, two kind of
iconic
movies. North Dakota, I think, just has Leprechaun. So we got that on them.
Well, it's claiming on Google, it's claiming that the 37 A Star Is Born takes place in North Dakota.
Whoa.
So, I don't know. You might actually have that. I don't know. There's Monster Trucks takes place in North Dakota.
Oh, this 100%. List, USA Today did a list of the most iconic movies set in every state, and it says that Logan is set in North Dakota. And Logan is a more famous movie than Leprechaun. Unfortunately.
I think it just came out more recently. I think Leprechaun has an enduring legacy within the culture.
It does. It really does, Emily. You know? Don't dispute that.
Okay.
So, okay. As we wrap this up, I do need to ask the question that's on everybody's mind, which is, what is your favorite Jennifer Aniston movie?
Leprechaun? No. I got to look at a filmography, because I feel like...
Here's the thing. There are two that jump out at me. The first is The Good Girl,
sure,
the Mike White movie, which is a great movie that I feel like a lot of people haven't seen, that she's legitimately great in, and was a movie that, you know, as a snooty fucking cinephile back in 2002 when it came out, was sort of the moment when I think a lot of us were like, oh, there is more range here than I think we're giving credence to, and that Jennifer Aniston has, you know, a lot more possibilities. But then she just goes and does Bruce Almighty the next year and Along Came Polly, and it's kind of the same, you know, stuff. I would say, though, she's great in Office Space, a great 1999 movie that she's sort of forgotten that she's in it. You know what I mean? I think that people don't really think of it as a Jennifer Aniston movie, but she is in it. My question as well, baked into the question that I just asked you guys, which is, what's your favorite Jennifer Aniston movie, is Jennifer Aniston, was Jennifer Aniston, has Jennifer Aniston ever been a movie star?
In the very specific role of, she could play a famous man's love interest. That was the thing that she was like. She was I think there are some movie stars who are add-on movie stars. A movie by themselves is very difficult. Sometimes they can carry it, but most of the time they're like a value add to the package. I think she was I think she was one of those. I think Reese Witherspoon is a movie star, but I think a lot of the time she also can be an add. Like, the great thing about Reese is she can be either. She can be like the add-on, or she can be the star herself. And I think Jennifer Aniston can't quite Well, I agree with you. Good Girl's probably her best performance. I also want to shout out, I think she's very good in The Iron Giant, which is a voice performance, but she's very warm and very maternal good. And wonderful in that.
So to your point about her being a movie star or not, my whole thing, and I think we had this discussion on the 99 podcast as well, Kenny and I, but I just don't think that she ever got to a place where people were going to see a movie because Jennifer Aniston was in it.
Yeah.
And that to me is the definition of a movie star, right? Like Reese Witherspoon is a perfect example. People went to see movies because Reese Witherspoon was in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't ever think that Jennifer Aniston ever crossed that threshold. But Jude, what were your thoughts?
I think that Jennifer Aniston, for me, like she sort of calcified into the all-American girl role once she was on Friends. Like I think of her as being like an early 2000s, like a Kate Hudson, you know, sort sure. of Katherine Heigl, maybe Sarah Jessica Parker, I think was definitely in this space for a while. Like I think of her as like, a rom-com is opening and she's on the poster. Like the breakup yeah. is mm-hmm. a Jennifer Aniston moment for me. You know, sure. I can't remember if she was in He's Just Not That Into You, but it feels like if she wasn't, she should have been.
I think she was. Yeah. Was she in that? Yeah, she was so. In that. Which I mean, you're absolutely right, Jude.
Really interesting and funny in her own right. But that said, I think that my favorite Jennifer Aniston movie is Leprechaun. Because it features both Jennifer Aniston and a lesson about, you know, not valuing money over personal connections. And
which is a lesson Rachel had to learn on Friends. Go ahead.
We all need
exactly.
to learn that.
Yeah. Exactly. It's a proto Rachel movie. You can see her working her craft.
I will say like she comes on Friends. And I, like every woman in America, wanted to look just like her. Every white woman in America. Like, I absolutely, there were obviously people who wanted to look like Monica or Bebe or whatever. But, like, I saw the first couple episodes of that show and I was like, yeah, I want to be Rachel. Rachel's mm-hmm. my, there is this, like, of all of the Friends, she has had a long and successful career outside of Friends. But of all of the Friends, I think she's had the hardest time escaping the gravitational pull of Rachel. And I think it's just because that character, as soon as she was on television, I specifically wanted to be her. And that's what sets our cultural expectations. So
I think you're absolutely right that the irony of what you're saying to some degree is that I think of the Friends stars. She is the one that became the biggest movie star mm-hmm. and yet was never fully able to pull herself out of kind of that pull of the Rachel role.
Lisa Kudrow's done the most interesting work outside of Friends. Schwimmer is a constant, like, interesting presence in things. Like,
sure.
Yeah. You know, Perry and LeBlanc struggled a bit more, but, like, have found, like, strong things.
They're TV stars.
Yeah, they're TV stars. And they, yeah.
Perennial TV stars.
Courtney Cox is, you know, she has the Scream franchise at minimum, and she's proven to be like an interesting, weird actor because she has an edge of obnoxiousness that they didn't really tap until later on in Friends.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously, I really loved Cougar Town, and I think that, like, that rides so much on the fact that she can play an obnoxious person in a way that is endearing. And, like, But yeah, Aniston absolutely became the biggest movie star.
It is just really interesting how, like, having watched every episode of The Morning Show.
Okay.
Anyone had done that.
You know, it was a weird thing. I watched, like, the pilot when it came out, and I was like, I don't really want to watch this. And then a few months ago, a friend told me that Reese goes to space in the premiere of the third season. And I was like, I need to find out how that
just
happened.
Like the Leprechaun.
Just like the Leprechaun. Listen, I'm not here to ride for The Morning Show, but I'll just say that Jennifer Aniston in that show, in particular, I would say in the third season, she's got bona fides. Like, she can fucking do it. Like, she can do things. I just think we undersold her. And also, you know, she kind of took the money and took the roles and kind of put herself in a box that she just never was fully able to get out of. It's just sort of what it is.
I watched season one of The Morning Show, and I don't think I've watched any others. And, like, my whole memory of it is I wrote kind of a negative review, just a slightly negative review. And I was friendly with the showrunner because she had worked on Bates Motel. which was a show I covered very warmly. And she like wrote me an email and was like, here's all the things that you, you know, missed about what we're trying to do here. And I just was like, okay. And I watched season one and thought it was fine. And then that was the end of my, maybe I'll get hired to write on it now. Who knows? Maybe I'll become a morning show.
You never know. Person. You might be a moon shower or yeah. whatever. Yeah. I don't know. It's the only reason that I bring it up is that I think that Jennifer Aniston and unfortunately a lot of women in her demographic seem to be gravitating more and more towards television because there are richer roles to be had in theory, or at least quote unquote roles for women over 50 or in their late 40s, what have you. And I think that the morning show, an idea and a thing that was kind of sculpted by Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon's production companies and like was a thing they tried to build from the ground themselves is just a fascinating thing in and of itself as to how they perceive themselves and how they think everyone else perceives them. There's just a lot of like odd things about that show.
You know how the David Gordon Green Halloween movies are like, it's mm-hmm. been all this time, but Laurie Strode is now like a doomsday prepper. She's ready for Michael Myers. We got to get Aniston back. We got to get her back to the Leprechaun franchise. And she's got to do that same thing. She's traumatized by this experience and she's locked all her doors. She's ready for that Leprechaun to come back. And when he does, baby, it's going to be great. My only other thought on the morning show is while I was home for Thanksgiving, my sister was watching the morning show. And so my mom sat down and was like, I'm going to watch a single episode of the morning show.
Sure.
And then she came upstairs and was like, I didn't really get it.
Was it the January 6th episode?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Because Reese Witherspoon, by the way, was at January 6th, just in case you guys weren't aware.
Oh, no.
Covering it, or was she January 6th?
She was like January
6th. No, she was covering it.
Her universe, yeah.
Yeah. She was covering it, and then she got trapped in there and discovered that her brother was actually there. And then she destroyed footage of her brother. It's a whole thing, guys.
Wow.
It's a crazy show.
Why does she go to space? To find the leprechaun?
She goes to space because John Hamm, who's sort of the antagonist in the third season, is sort of this Elon Musk figure who owns like rockets and spaceships and stuff. So he takes them to space.
Can I just say, I watched Leprechaun. And then, which is a movie about an ancient being that is in North Dakota and kills people indiscriminately. And my wife and I are watching season 5 of Fargo, which also has an ancient being who lives in North Dakota and kills people indiscriminately. I was like, this is all kind of, it's all
and John Hamm.
But it also has John Hamm in like a totally wonderful, he's like playing a monster and like he's so good at it. My larger point is that in season 4 of the morning show, Jennifer Aniston should go to space and she should meet the leprechaun there. And
this is what
by the way, all comes together.
Jennifer Aniston to me is like a lady Matthew McConaughey, where like she just sort of fossilized into being like agreeable and likable and just generally affable. And we need her to have like her true detective moment. We need something that's dark and sad and that brings us to an appreciation of what a strange actor she's always been. And I think, Emily, that you are the one who's going to bring that to us.
I think so,
with Jennifer Aniston fighting the leprechaun in space.
She's going to win an Oscar for that.
I think so.
I think so, too. So am I mistaken? I never saw this movie, but there was a movie that she was in called Cake that came out a few years
that
ago.
And McConaughey's a great example because like he won his Oscar right around the time Cake came out. And it was like this thing of like, are these like rom-com stars? Do we need to like reclaim them? And Cake is, I never saw it either, but it's a dark movie that like critics didn't really like, but apparently she was good in it. She almost got an Oscar nomination. Like she got all the precursors.
Yeah.
She got pushed out in favor of, I don't know, some other lady.
Well, I conceptually, all I know about that movie is that like she has a lot of scars on her face, if I'm not mistaken. And I think that that's tough. I think it's and by that, I mean, it's like, do you remember the fucking Man Who Had No Face that or whatever the Mel Gibson movie where he like scarred up his face? Like, you know, these movie stars that want to kind of get you to forget that they're movie stars and stop looking at them as sort of these beautiful objects. And they want to kind of, you know. But I always find that stuff feels a little bit it just makes me feel gross and kind of icky. And it feels like you're not, you know what I mean? There are people that legitimately, unfortunately suffer from any number of, you know, deformities or what have you. And it's, I don't know, using that to try to get an Oscar nomination is a little bit.
Yeah. Like, look, I'm not just pretty. Yeah. That's a little bit weird.
You know what I'm saying?
It's definitely like, it's an addiction movie, which is another thing that the Academy often likes. But yeah, she is in a car crash and has still dealing with the after effects of that and has chronic pain. So she starts abusing painkillers. And it's a movie about her like learning to live with chronic pain. I'm reading the Wikipedia page. She was nominated for the Globe and the SAG. It is kind of surprising.
So it was legit that she was like in the conversation.
She was, I think, right on the cusp. I'm going to see who was nominated instead. Hold, please.
But I certainly don't mean to suggest that the filmmakers or the Jennifer Aniston in any, you know, way are trying to they're trying to shine a light on a real thing, right? On addiction and on the various things that happen. But, you know.
Okay. So the four who were nominated everywhere alongside Aniston, and Aniston gets pushed out, but it's won by Julianne Moore for Still Alice. Felicity Jones for The Theory of Everything, which I think is she's fine in that movie.
Fine.
Rosamund Pike for Gone Girl, iconic character. My whole aesthetic is Oscar. Taken from her. Yeah. I actually could see Reese winning for Wild. I liked her a lot in that movie. She's fantastic.
That movie's great, and she's great in it.
Jennifer Aniston gets pushed out by the person I would vote for, who is Marion Cotillard in 2 Days, One Night, which is like a brilliant, harrowing performance, and it's surprising the Oscars went for it, but good for them.
That is interesting. Yeah, I mean, the Theory of Everything is just such a like shrug of a movie to me. Like it already doesn't really exist. It's also just like everything about it. Speaking of like someone winning an Oscar for, you know, playing someone that's challenged in
what
some way.
I am fascinated by is how many trans people think that Eddie Redmayne won for The Danish Girl. He did not. Ooh. He won for The Theory of Everything. And I think that we're conflating Jared Leto winning for Dallas Buyers Club with Eddie Redmayne getting nominated for Danish Girl. And like those are 2 years apart. And already by the time Eddie Redmayne's playing a trans woman, there's like, he shouldn't be doing this. And then like when Jared Leto did it, everyone was like, what a brave performance. It's like in those 2 years, something shifted. It's
amazing
wild.
How quickly it shifts. I mean, the Danish Girl is, I mean,
everyone it's crazy. Everyone associated with that movie is in jail now. So,
except for the Academy Award that Alicia Vikander has on her mantle.
Listen, even she knows that's for Ex Machina. Even she knows that's for Ex Machina.
I mean, okay, I hope so. Yeah, it is really interesting what you're saying that like you just would never even go close to a Danish Girl today or a Dallas Buyers Club. It's pretty amazing.
I wrote a novel and with we talk sometimes my publisher about the film and TV rights, and like one of the characters in it is an early in transition trans woman, and I've been like, if you do this as a movie, you kind of almost have to cast a cis male actor to play that part, and I have always kind of been like, yeah, but I'll be there, it'll be fine. I could just tell him what to do. I'll just be like, hey, J.K. Simmons. I don't know why I think J.K. Simmons is going to play this part.
All right.
Because it's a 35-year-old. This is how you do this, J.K. Simmons. Good for you. But no, it is. It is this like it is a thing where like, yeah, now you'd never do that.
You'd never do that.
Jude, go ahead. I cut you off.
No, I mean, it is like, I think one of those things where the conversation shifted so quickly, and we're still learning how to like talk about trans people's bodies. Like with your novel, which I've read parts of, like, I understand why you might need a cis male actor. I remember when Laverne Cox was on Orange is the New Black, like her pre-transition flashbacks were just very helpfully played by her twin brother, you know? But like, I don't know. I don't know if you could find an actress who would be willing to like go that far back in the closet to play someone who wasn't out yet, you know?
Yeah, there's like I had a friend who wrote a comedy pilot about someone early in transition. It was very funny, and I was like, who are you going to cast in this? And she was like, you know what, I think that we can find someone who wants to transition alongside the show. And I was like, that is that's a needle in a haystack, and B, I don't actually know if you can do that, because those like, I mean, those early years of transition, I can't believe we're talking about this in the Leprechaun episode, but those early years of transition are like, you know, it's like when you're 13 and 14 and kind of don't want like photos of you ever to surface again. So like sure. having someone, obviously an actor who wanted to do that would be wonderful. And we love actors, and actors are inherently used to having their faces everywhere. So like, sure. but it is like this. Yeah. It is this like weird question of how you had, cause like one of the few times I've been okay with a cis person playing a trans person is on the TV show, Mr. Robot. BD Wong plays a trans woman, but the whole point of the character is that she has never been allowed to self-actualize because she just like, she's only this person when she's, you know, in private or with certain trusted confidants. And the rest of the time she appears to the world like this guy. And like, I was totally cool with BD Wong playing that part, but some trans people weren't. Anyway, the point is the Danish girl is a catastrophe.
It is. At the end of our episodes, Jude, what we tend to do is rate our films from 0 to 99, 0 being the lowest, 99 being the highest, 50 being the line of demarcation of recommending a film to somebody. Mm-hmm. We do two ratings, one before the podcast and one after, to see if the conversation has changed your opinions on the film. Yeah. I will start. I came into this film at a 10. But
is that higher or lower than Cool World?
Much lower.
Lower than Cool? Oh my God.
Cool World. Yeah, I'm sorry, Emily. Ugh. But Cool World like is obviously a disgusting, terrible experience, but like it's at least visually interesting.
I have seen a lot of bad movies in my life, and Cool World is one of the 10 worst. So we're gonna fight.
But the point is that this conversation has changed my opinion on this film, and I have gone up. I've gone up to a 25.
Hell yeah. Let's keep that going up. Let's keep that going up. Leprechaun.
So I'm at a 25 now. I came into this. I found this a pretty miserable experience as I texted Emily. It just maybe it was my headspace as well. If I'm being completely honest, I was just grumpy that day.
Well, I don't think you have to apologize for not enjoying Leprechaun.
But it was an unenjoyable experience. But our conversation has made me respect this film a lot more to some degree. So I'm at a 25. Emily, where are you at?
I came into this episode being like, can I put this higher than Toys or will I be fired? I gave Toys a 49.5, and I've been sitting here the whole time being like, what do I give Leprechaun? And I'm going to give it a 49.3. So it's 2/10 below Great. Toys. It's, I cannot in any good conscience say this is a good movie, but I had so much fun with it. And again, it gave me sort of a nostalgic vibe, even though I had never seen this movie when it came out. It just to me is like sitting in a room and Angela Barrick's right there and she's going and like covering her eyes. And I'm like, I'm one of the girls now. I'm having such a good time with the girls. And, you know, that is what Leprechaun means to me. Queer phobia scale. I think I got to give it like a 2. There wasn't a lot of overt queer phobia in this. It's so much worse on so many other categories, but for queer phobia, although, you know, again, this is the thing with so many of these movies, you know, all these people have told like anti-gay jokes so many times. Absolutely. We just aren't seeing them.
Same with the Leprechaun.
Oh yeah, that Leprechaun's a homophobe.
Sure. You know what I love though? I love imagining you watching Leprechaun in the wee hours of the night.
Yeah.
So Jude, what about you? What's your rating on this?
So I came in on this at a 300, and I'm leaving it like a 750. But to sort of translate it back down to the scale that I think other people will appreciate. I think I am rating this again on a curve on like I've seen Prom Night 4, which barely deserved to be a movie at all. Like they're in its field. There are so many movies that do so much less than this with their silliness that I think it's you have to go into it being like, I'm watching Leprechaun and my disability politics are going to take a heavy blow today. I'm going to donate to some fucking organizations afterward. But like on that scale, I'd give it a 60. I'd give it a, this is fun. You're not going to want to see this every night of your life, but if you need to like relax, kick back, enjoy Irish cultural heritage with the seriousness and respect it deserves, that's what this will do for you.
You just need to crack open a cold one with the boys. The boys are loved on the Leprechaun. Then
Leprechaun's absolutely.
I do think that like what is coming through here is Jude and I have seen a lot of bad slashers, and Phil, I'm guessing you haven't seen like.
I guess not.
Within this field, this movie has a level of craft that is appreciated.
I mean, okay. That's just an experience thing.
Go
that I don't have.
Leprechaun.
And so next week,
actually, I'm going to add an extra 15 points for Jennifer Aniston getting to deliver the line. It's the 90s, pal. Women are treated equal, because I think that actually makes it socially redeeming. It's a feminist movie, albeit not socially progressive on many other fronts.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that. But but next week on this podcast, we'll be covering Louis Malle's Damage, just for a real whiplash turn, with Brooke Solomon and Jordan Gustafson from the Queer Quadrant podcast. We'll be talking about why you shouldn't sleep with your son's fiance. It's bad. Bad things happen.
Jude, have you ever seen Damage?
I have not. It sounds like... when you said that, I had like an instant feeling of grown-ups having a discussion about how emotionally hard it was. I'm not sure.
You understand Damage better than you think.
It's it is a movie that I don't recommend. I don't think it's a good movie. I think Leprechaun is a better movie than Damage. But it is a movie, like, as someone who is in a committed lesbian relationship, but also like is frequently like, I think there's like a lot of me that is like heterosexual and has not gotten to explore mm-hmm. that part of myself. That movie made me be able to put that, having that reckoning with myself, off for like another 2 years, because it makes heterosexuality look like the most terrifying thing imaginable. So you should watch it.
You get to see Jeremy Irons naked running down a stairwell, though. So ooh. I mean, you've got that going for you if that's something you're interested in.
It has. Do look up the sex scenes on YouTube, because they are
crazy,
bonkers. This takes place in the days before intimacy coordinators, but it also mm-hmm. takes place in the days before anybody knew what sex was. So it's just like two people like thrashing around.
There's this moment where Juliette Binoche is flailing her arms. It almost, to your point, Emily, it's like aliens who don't know how sex works are just being like, this is what humans do, right?
I went looking for this video. I went looking for video of this on YouTube to send it to my friend, because I was like, I think these are the worst sex scenes I've ever seen. And I sent it to her. And like, I believe the title of it is like one of those things that YouTube people use to get around copyright, where it's like, he fell in love with his son's fiance. Now they're having an affair. And like one of the top comments was just somebody being like, very hot. And I was like, no, it is not. Nope. You are incorrect, sir.
Sir, you are wrong. This is not hot.
I don't know why I assumed it's a sir, but come on.
It's probably a sir. I mean, if it's... Yeah. Jude, where can people read you, listen to you, see you? Plug away.
The easiest way to find me is that I have a newsletter that comes out about once a week, and it's jude-doyle.ghost.io.
Yep. It's a wonderful newsletter. It's one of my favorites, one that I subscribe to a lot of newsletters, and that's one of the ones I do read every week. So a lot of them just
a newsletter that you have received in your inbox more than once. Yeah.
I do want to stand for The Neighbors. If you can find a copies of that, that's a wonderful, and your other series Maw, both wonderfully written, great horror comics that I think are worth people seeking out. I'm a huge fan of your, and we're friends, but I'm also a huge fan of your work, so I'm just going to keep being like,
well, I'm just a huge fan of you, so I'm so happy you said that, because it makes it less creepy.
And we're all,
it's a love fest here on Leprechaun.
We're all huge fans of the Leprechaun, so not the film, but the Leprechaun himself.
No, the Leprechaun himself, for sure. Absolutely. I mean,
he's a go-getter.
I mean, listen, he gets his gold back, guys. I'm just saying. He is successful.
Good for him.
Yeah. Jude, thank you so much for doing this. We very much appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I really, really loved this. Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
Absolutely. We can't wait to have you back in the future.
I had a thing I was going to tell you at the end, and I don't remember what it was, so I'll just text it to you.
Perfect. Well, this has been St. Patrick's Day.
Happy St. Patrick's Day to all of America.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Podcast Nuggets. 1992. Podcast Nuggets. Podcast Nuggets.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.